My wife got me this for Christmas, and I'll tell you what it is. It tracks your activity, and it makes sure that you get up and move, because I have a tendency not to move. I like to sit and read and drink coffee and occasionally eat. But this was my wife's way of getting something that occasionally comes up and pokes me and says, hey, get up, go do something, exercise, walk. So most of the time, I've been doing a pretty good job of walking. I try to get 10,000 steps in a day. It's about 5 miles. But, you know, if you do things like mow the lawn or walk around the church auditorium, that adds up too. But anyway, I was preaching about a month ago, Paul, and I was getting ready to make a pretty important point toward the end of the sermon, and it started vibrating. And I looked down, just thought, you know, who on earth are you to bother me at a really importune time like this? And I looked down, it says, you have 124 more steps to go this hour. Get moving. I thought, I'll get moving when the invitation's done. I can't do this right now. So I've been over at the hotel fooling with this morning. The thing froze up. So I had to call, text. You ever do that with a phone or any kind of technical device? You call tech support. If you ever start thinking that you're smart, just call tech support, and you'll feel like the biggest idiot the Lord put on the earth. And I was going through that today, and the guy's walking me through steps. Now, push this button. The way you'd talk to a two-year-old. I get that a lot. I was we were doing some landscaping around the church that we're meeting in right now, and I was given the really important skill job of shoveling wood chips and mulch, because that's about my skill level. I can't build anything or paint anything or anything significant, so I was doing that. And my dad was in charge of the whole thing. He was an engineer from General Motors, very smart man. And so he's explaining. I said, well, how much do I need to order? How is he? He said, well, son, there's a formula for it. It's length times width times depth. And my wife is standing next to him. She said, he's never going to figure it out. And I said, I'm standing right here. I'm right here, literally, okay? And the way you talk to a two-year-old, you know, so I get that sometimes. But anyway, this seems to be working. It hadn't told me I need to do a bunch of steps yet. But I figured something out, Paul. And those young preachers, they annoy me on a lot of levels, but not the least of which, they preach like they're double parked. Have you noticed that? It's always this. And I just want to say, would you just stand still and tell us what you got to tell us? So if you see that, I've decided a long time ago I'm not going to pace. I think it just makes people nervous. So anyway, that's probably more news than you care to hear. What do you think about this phrase? When a dog bites a man, that is not news, because it happens so often. But if a man bites a dog, well, that's news. And that probably is the case. A few years ago, this fiery, red-headed singer-songwriter named Nico Case wrote a song titled, People Got a Lot of Nerve, and ain't it the truth. But there was an interesting lyric in it that played out in the pages of the newspapers about the time that the song came out. She said, you know they call them killer whales, but you seem surprised when it pinned you down to the bottom of the tank where you can't turn around. If you can remember far enough back, the date was February the 24th, 2010, when these two people pictured here during an event at SeaWorld in Orlando, a 12,000-pound killer whale by the name of Tilikum grabbed this young lady by her blonde ponytail. Her name was Dawn Brancho. She was the trainer. He dragged her into the tank and thrashed her body around before drowning her. Now, that's a pretty awful thing. I mean, this woman obviously had her whole life in front of her, and you just hear something like that, and you shake your head. A tragedy, to be sure. Well, many Americans, when that happened, were shocked by this, which probably tells you more than you need to know about many Americans. Again, that line in the song, you know they call them what? Killer whales. That's kind of what they do. And for days after the tragedy, it was almost impossible to avoid the story. Media were saturated with it, sharing all sorts of history and details. And among all the things that they shared, I found the most relevant to be this. That particular whale had already been involved in two other deaths since the year 1991. In other words, this wasn't the first time that this had happened. Well, at the time that all this was going on, I was going through one of those daily Bible readings where you start January the 1st and you quit the 31st of December and you make it all the way through the Bible. Would you believe the reading that week was from Exodus chapter 21? Notice what it says. And this probably would come into play in Texas, where you got all those giant cows and ones with horns. If a bull gores a man or a woman to death, the bull must be stoned to death, and its meat must not be eaten. But if the owner of the bull will not be held responsible, but if, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned, but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or a woman, the bull must be stoned, and the owner must also be put to death. However, if payment is demanded of him, he may redeem his life by paying whatever is demanded. This law also applies if the bull gores a son or a daughter. If the bull gores a male or female slave, the owner must pay 30 shekels of silver to the master of the slave, and the bull must be stoned. Now, thousands and thousands of years ago, when Israel wasn't even really much of a nation at that point, there were laws that governed against such activity, even on the part of animals. And here, the Word of God very clearly states that if that animal was known for its dangerous propensities, the owner was responsible for protecting other people from it. And that's good advice. Even if today most Americans are far too sophisticated to consult an ancient text for advice on life. Again, the killer whale doing what killer whales do. It's killing things. Americans just haven't figured this out very well. I'm not guessing from this audience, a lot of you are big Las Vegas people. I'm not either. I've only been once in my life, and that was just for like a day to see the Beatles acrobatic show. But there's been a show that was going on forever in Las Vegas starring these two Germans. What are their names? Siegfried and Roy. Exactly. Well, they had a show at least until that white tiger that's right in the middle of them mauled Roy. Again, you played with cats before. Cats are kind of sadistic creatures. You ever see one with a mouse or a squirrel? Yeah, you know what they do. They have it in them to kill things as well. Well, all kinds of folks speculated that what happened here was that the tiger went crazy. He lost his mind. He went crazy. Comedian Chris Rock said this. He said, that tiger didn't go crazy. That tiger went tiger. That's what they do, okay? Tigers just go ahead and, you know, they look at those guys like they're just a couple of big fluffy balls of yarn there, and here he goes right after it. And amazingly, when the incident took place at SeaWorld, same kind of speculation was just going all over the place. What happened? What caused Tilikum, the killer whale, to behave this way? Did he go crazy? If so, why? Now, I barely understand people. I don't know a lot about animals, and I'd probably do best to stay out of that, but a little friendly advice here. An animal created by God to swim up to 70 miles a day in the ocean, hunting, killing, and eating all the while, is imprisoned in a bare concrete box. It has a brain that's larger than a human brain. How could it stay mentally healthy in such a habitat? The whale was simply doing what God made it to do. That's what animals generally do. And I'm crazy about animals. Right now, this is my favorite animal. Her name is Mavis. My wife, we'd had two dogs. We've been married for, 34 years, I guess. We had two dogs in that time. They both lived a long time. Well, when our last dog, Ringo, died, November of 2017, I guess it was, I was just inconsolable. I mean, that dog and I were just like frickin' frack. We went everywhere together, had all kinds of adventures, and I sat in my chair for a couple of 3 months just contemplating my place in the universe. Well, my wife Susan came home with this little 35-pound bundle of mayhem. She was a shelter dog, a terrier, and I mean, you talk about rushing to keep up. I got a walker 4 miles a day, and someone looked at us the other day, and they said, "I noticed something about you, Chuck." And I said, "What's that?" Said, "You're not walking that dog. That dog's walking you." And I said, "That's probably true." Well, a couple of nights ago, Susan sent me a text. It was after our Monday night meeting, I think. She said, "Well, it finally happened." And I said, "What finally happened?" Said, "Mavis got a squirrel." Mavis is in our backyard. That's her standing on our deck right now. And these squirrels have been taunting her since she showed up a year ago. You ever watch those squirrels? Those squirrels are, you know, they're kind of disagreeable little trolls. And they'd stand on the deck and they'd just look at her. And I think if squirrels could laugh, they were laughing at her. It was like, "You ain't going to get me. I'm just going to hurl myself into the tree, or I'm going to jump up on the fence, and it ain't going to happen." Well, one of them got a little bit slovenly, and he is now in squirrel heaven. And Mavis did not get yelled at. Mavis was actually congratulated. You know why? She's doing what God made her to do. It's funny, when we got that terrier, we didn't have to tell her, "Now, those little things over there are rodents, and they are the enemy." She just, like, she knew it. She just, "This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to chase every rodent out of this yard until I get one of them." And finally, it happened. Now, that's one of the most consistent things about the world in which we live. Most of the creatures in this natural world are like Mavis, or they're like Tilikum, or they're like that tiger. They just do what God made them to do. And most of them didn't have to go to a training class. They didn't have to go to obedience school or anything else. That's just instinct that the good Lord gave them. All of that got me thinking, how would that apply to us? What were you and I made to do? I mean, clearly, one of the things I was made to do is go eat at Rose's Cafe, and I'm doing a bang-up job of that. But probably there are some more significant things per God's plan for everyone that we could say that we were put here to do. Let's think about some of those out loud. We were put here to live. During the incarnation, as God came down in the person of his Son, Hebrews 10 gives a really interesting snapshot of just what was involved in that. It says, when Christ came into the world, he said, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. I have come to do your will, O God." You realize that the duality of human beings is that we have a body, a physical body, and we have a spiritual soul. The Greeks were constantly wrestling with this concept. They couldn't decide if it was this or if it was that, or if it was that or if it was this. In fact, a movement that would develop into full-blown Gnosticism would teach that the physical body is actually nothing. What's important is the spiritual. The Bible doesn't say anything like that. The Bible actually says that the body and the soul are both important. They're both significant. Nowhere will you see in the New Testament the call to just do anything you want to do physically because the physical body counts for nothing. You won't see that. You will see that the physical body is part and parcel of who we are. And after the resurrection, as the new heaven and the new earth come together and we're in the presence of God forever, you do understand we're going to have a body. Jesus had a resurrected body. It was walking through walls. It was walking on the beach. It was eating a piece of broiled fish for breakfast. I'm not entirely certain of what that's going to be like, but part and parcel of what we're put here to do is to inhabit this body that God has given us. And as one of the great songwriters, Bruce Springsteen, said, it ain't no sin to be glad you're alive. God gave us the gift of life. Part of what we're to do with that, we're to live. We're to enjoy one another's company. I love the thought that we see elsewhere in the Bible that, there's nothing wrong but eating the food that God's given you to eat, to drink, to work, to enjoy each other's company. That's part and parcel of life. There's some people that they're so afraid, they're so timid that something bad might happen. Let me spill the beans for you. Something bad's going to happen. I'm going to get sick. You're going to get sick. We're going to die. People we love are going to die. What do? You live. That's what you do. That's what Jesus did while he was here to inhabit that body. You live your life. Don't ever let anyone cheat you out of that. There are some people, for some reason, that they're letting the world go by. And they're not much participating in it. And that's a shame. So we're here to live. We're also here to grow. Luke 2 and 52 is one of those rare verses that tells us a little bit about what Jesus did between the ages of 12 and 30. Have you ever wondered why God, for whatever reason, chose not to give us a lot of biographical detail about what Jesus did during those couple of decades? I'd kind of like to know. There are some apocryphal books that have him doing all kinds of things, and you look at those and you figure out why the early church said that shouldn't be part of the canon. Because it shouldn't be. But we do know this, and this, even though it's very sparse in verbiage, tells us something about what our task is as well. And Jesus grew in wisdom, in stature, and in favor with God and man. What do we want for our kids, for our grandkids, for these little ones that are here at school? We want them to do the same thing. We want them to learn. We want them to gain knowledge. We want them to grow in wisdom. We want them physically to develop. It's what we're here to do. We're here to grow. Kind of interesting. If I'd guess, the median age in here is probably about 67 or so. I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt, might be a little higher. But, haven't you all figured out most of this stuff by now? You have. I guarantee you there are people in here been studying the Bible probably longer than I've been alive. So why are you here? You're here to continue to grow in wisdom. John and I were discussing the work of a preacher the other day as we were riding around his truck, and I thought of something that my father-in-law had said. My father-in-law's been on the faculty in the administration at Oklahoma Christian since the early 1950s. His name's Stafford North. Some of you might have heard of him. I married his youngest daughter. That's my claim to the family and his cross to bear, I suppose. But Stafford said something to me in the mid-80s when I started preaching. He just looked at me, and he didn't sugarcoat it. He said, if you quit studying, you're dead. That's a fact. I can see preachers that quit studying, and a lot of them have almost quit being relevant. It's not that they don't know the important things of the Bible. They don't know the things that are happening in the world. And you know what you do? You get those sermons up with the newspaper in one hand and the Bible in the other. And you let the Bible interpret those newspapers, not the other way around. Well, that's part of being a citizen of the world. You grow. You're trying to gain in wisdom and knowledge and stature and favor with God and man. God put us here to grow. One of the remarkable things about this world is that if you live to be 150, you're never going to know but about this much of what's gone on. What a marvelous challenge and a great opportunity that is. So we're here to grow. We're also here to work. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 24 says that we need to find satisfaction in all the toil that God gives us to do all the days of our lives. Now, if you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, there are times I think that fella needs a pep talk. Now, whether that's Solomon writing or someone from the perspective of Solomon, if you listen to some of the scholars, I don't suppose it matters because it's all inspired. But if you read that book, he comes across a bit pessimistic at times, a bit negative. But there are some wonderful things in there that help guide our lives in addition to that. This is one of those passages. Enjoy the things that God has put before you to do. I got to speak on Monday in chapel at the school here. And we were talking about the passage where Jesus said, "The one who is faithful in little will also be faithful in much." That's a fact. I asked the kids if they knew what it meant, and they did. They had a pretty good take on that. And I told them a story about a great American by the name of Booker T. Washington. Washington was born a slave in Virginia, and the Emancipation Proclamation was issued when he was at the tender age of 9 years old. And it was great that on the one hand, they had freedom. It was a little frightening on the other hand that now it's every man for himself. You better go and be able to make your way in the world. And he worked at this job and at that job. But finally, he decided as a young man, he said, "I've got to get an education." He didn't have much money. He didn't have many prospects. So he basically makes his way hundreds of miles to a place called Hampton, Virginia, where Hampton Institute was. It was a school that was built after the Civil War for the education of freedmen, of former slaves. And Washington comes into the place, and he's ragged. He's been on the road for weeks. He's got kind of dirty, disheveled clothes. He hasn't eaten very well. He said, "I didn't make much of an impression, I'm sure." He said that the lady that was in charge of things was an older white lady, very prim, very proper, dressed to the nines. And she inquired of his presence. And he said, "Well, I'm here to be admitted as a student, if you'll have me." And she looked him up and down. And she went over in the corner of the room and she got a broom. And she said, "Sweep out this recitation room." And he said, "You've never had anybody in the history of the world take a job on with more gusto than I did. I swept it, and I swept it again, and I swept it a third time." He said, "You couldn't find a speck of dust in there," which was good because a while later she came in and had white gloves on, and she started touching the floor and the baseboards, and it was just immaculate. And she looked at the young 16-year-old boy, and she said, "I suppose you'll do to enter this institution." You probably know he went on to do greater things still. Why? He was faithful in the little things, and God would give him greater things to do still. That's part of the attitude that we're to have toward work. Show me somebody that doesn't want to work, and I'll show you someone that doesn't understand the nature of God. Paul instructs the church at Thessalonica thusly: "If a man will not work, neither shall he eat." Okay, that's true for everyone. I hope that in your life, even if you're retired, that you're still working, that you're still serving, that you're still doing things. I don't care if you're working on the garden or you're canning food or you're volunteering somewhere, you're teaching. You find something to do. God made us to do things. He made us to work. He made us to be busy. I'm on the radio during football season there in Little Rock as the pigskin preacher. I come in and we make predictions about college football games and run our mouths for about 3 hours. It's a lot of fun. Last fall, if you remember, the Powerball jackpot was up to just some ridiculous amount of money. It was at some $700 million. So one of the guys that was on the radio that day with us, he walks into the studio. We're all sitting in our seats, and he starts handing out these little slips of paper. Now, I didn't know what it was. I'd never bought a lottery ticket. And they were lottery tickets. And he was giving them out to everybody. And I said, "Well, what's this for?" He said, "Well, the jackpot's up to $740 million. And they're announcing it tonight. And you might win with this." And they were asking a bunch of questions. I said, "Well, as a preacher, if you won, would you keep that money?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "The devil's had his hands on it long enough. It's time the Lord gets his hands on it." I said, "We'd get out of that skating rink we're in, probably have a church, and I'm going to be involved in that nonsense." But it was interesting. They asked a question, and I think I was the only one that really understood the point I was trying to make. I still don't think the rest of them did. They went around, they said, now, if you won the lottery and you won $740 million, would you quit your job? Every one of them in there said yes. Most of them were employees of the radio station. One of them owned a steakhouse, owned a restaurant. Everyone, yes, I would quit. I would quit tomorrow. They got to me. They said, what about you, Pigskin? I said, no, I wouldn't quit. They said, yes, you would. I said, no, I wouldn't. I said, here's how this shakes out. I said, every Sunday that rolls around, every Lord's Day, I'm going to church. And I'm in a situation now where I get to talk. And I'm going to keep doing that, okay? I'm going to be in church anyway. And they kind of laughed at that a little bit. I wasn't really kidding. And I said this. I said, I really believe I was put here to tell people about the Lord. That's been the most significant thing I've accomplished in my 55 years on this planet. I said, why would I stop if I had a pile of money? I said, we might be a little more aggressive about getting the message out if we had that. I said, I wouldn't stop what I'm doing. No way. We're put here to work. And when you cease to find something to do, when you cease to find a contribution to make, you're on the downhill side of 40. You know that. We're here to do God's work. We're also here to seek. In Acts 17, one of my favorite sermons in all of Scripture, Paul is talking to the Athenians. He says a lot of things to them. But after telling them that God doesn't live in temples built by human hands as if he needed anything, and you know that they've got it all wrong with these temples and these statues and everything else, he says this. He said, from one man, he made every nation of men and determined the exact times and the set places where they should live. And then he adds this, God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. What's the point that Paul's making there? He's saying one of the reasons that we're alive, one of the reasons that God made each of us, is so that we would reach out and seek him. The book of James says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. That's what that phrase means. We're seeking after God. This is one of the great tragedies of the age in which we live. At a time when men and women know more about the natural world than we've ever known before, we see faith in God on the decline, at least in the West. You know why? Because people are so arrogant that they think that they've figured out the mysteries of life. They haven't figured out anything. We know a lot more about DNA. We've mapped the human genome. We know more about the heavens above. And yet, learned people, well, we don't need God anymore, because the only reason God was invented is that he explained these kinds of mysteries to pre-scientific people. And now that we know all these things scientifically, we've eliminated the need for God. And I'm thinking, you don't get it at all, do you? You ought to be able to look up and see the vastness of the universe. That ought to drive you to your knees. This morning, I can't wait to check it out a little bit later, scientists supposedly were going to have the first images of a black hole in the universe. An actual photograph of this. I want to see that, okay? I want to know more, though, about the God who made that universe and who made the planets and who made the galaxies and who made the black holes. How in the world, with our increased knowledge, does that decrease faith? I don't get it. David, living in ancient times, could stand on a windswept Judean hillside and say, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Yeah, David, except for American universities, because they don't hear the language, because they don't listen. We're here to seek after God. You want to read something fascinating, write this down. You'll be writing me thank you notes later when you get it. There's a fellow by the name of Bill Bryson. He usually writes travel logs. He goes over to Europe and goes through America and tells funny stories. Great writer. But he wrote a book about 15 years ago that ate up a good 5 years of his life. It's called A Short History of Nearly Everything. And this was his goal in sitting down writing this book. He said, I don't know a lot about science. He said, I'm an English guy, I'm a humanities guy, I'm a writer. I want to know more about science. So he sat down and researched all of the tremendous scientific discoveries and achievements from the dawn of time until the present. And if you never had a science class in your life, if you've never gotten past the sixth grade, if you sit down and read this book, you'll be conversant with just about anyone in the world in the realm of science. It's remarkable. I should add, Bryson is agnostic. He's not an atheist. He said, there might be a God. I don't know. I can't tell. He said, I'm not a religious person. But he doesn't have a bias to disprove God at all. In fact, the most fascinating chapter in the book is when he writes about the rise of life. And he's honest in doing this. And he says, you know, they had that experiment in 1953 at the University of Chicago with scientists Miller and Urey, and they got a couple of beakers and hooked them up and put rubber tubes in and put some water and then this. And then they hit it with an electric shock, and a few days later, it turned into a green broth. And they thought they discovered the secret of life. In fact, Miller said, if God didn't do it this way at the beginning, he missed a pretty good bet. And then Bryson says, here's the problem 50 years later. He said the early atmosphere, the early seas were nothing like we would imagine them to be. He said that didn't prove anything. He said we're no closer to creating life in a laboratory than they were back then. And he said, besides, here's the problem. The problem's not amino acids. The problem is proteins. You can't have life without proteins. And he begins to break this down and explain this in such a way that even a dullard like me could understand it. He said, to spell the word collagen, which is a type of protein, you need 8 letters in just the right order. You know, C-O-L-L-A-G-E-N. To make a cell of collagen, that protein, it's much more complicated. You would basically have to string in the genetic alphabet over 200 letters across in exactly the right sequence. And if one of them's out, the bet's off. It doesn't work. He said, here's a way that maybe you could understand this. I'm troubled that this is the second illustration I've used that somehow involves gambling. Imagine on the back of this wall, you've got a wall of slot machines. You know, you go up, the one-arm bandit, you go and you pull the machine down, and a letter comes up, or a cherry, or a dollar sign, or whatever those heathens have in those places. He said, to go ahead and to get collagen, you would have to pull those levers down, and it would have to come up over 200 in exactly the right sequence. He said, you know how long it would take to do that? He said, practically forever. He said, it's not going to come up in the right sequence accidentally. It won't. He said, the odds, and here's where this gets even weirder. You don't make collagen, it makes itself. He said, the odds against this happening are 1 in 10 to the 260th power. That is a greater number than the number of atoms in the universe. This is an agnostic saying life did not just happen. Somebody was outside of it, tinkering with it. We know all of this, and we're not going to seek God? Are we crazy? Yeah, I think we'd have to be. God wants us to seek him. Only human beings would be so arrogant to think that we don't need that. We need that more than we need anything. We're here to seek God. We're here to love. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Jesus says this is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Have you observed over the years the happiest, most contented people are the ones that understand something about love? They love their families. They love their spouse. They love their kids. They love their neighbors. They love their God. You take love out of life, life's not really worth living. Just one big frustration and one big irritation after the other. But with love at the center of our lives, well, it is worth living. And we can go on despite the heartaches, despite the hardships, despite the tragedies. Because love gives us the ability to do it. As Paul would say to the Corinthians, love covers a multitude of sins. And so it does. It covers a multitude of problems today. So, again, back to those animals that we talked about at the beginning. They're just doing the things that God put them here to do. But God put us here to do some things as well. To live, to grow, to work, to seek, to love. Is that what you're doing today? If that's so, keep it up. That's why we're here. If some of these things aren't present in your life, I'd encourage you to get busy while there's still time. You know, we talked about the generally pessimistic overtones of Ecclesiastes. I still love it. It's one of my favorite books because there's so much good practical advice there. But nowhere more so than this conclusion that is reached at the end of the book. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Sometime, soon or late, there's not really any way to tell, we're going to come to the end of life's little day. That's going to be basically the only thing that's going to matter when your time and mine come. Did we do the things that God put us here to do? Did we fear God? Did we keep his commandments? It's the whole reason that we're here. This is a big, big world. This is a big state. I'm already dreading that drive home tomorrow. I wish Paul would have told me. That drive takes 27 hours, even though it really only took 10 hours. And that was because of an hour traffic in Dallas. But this is a big place. It's a lot of people. A lot of people in Texas. People coming to Texas all the time. A lot of people in our world. You know, the world population recently passed the 7 billion mark. Here's the thing. Most of those 7 billion people, they don't understand this. If you do, you are part of an elite select group of people that despite all of the problems, all of the temptations, all of the distractions, you have figured out why you're here. Most people never figure that out. So the question is, are you doing what God asked you to do? May the Lord give us the strength to always be about our Father's business. Thanks for being here.